Blog Talk Radio.
This is Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Saturday, September 9th, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Well, those of us in America, we're bracing for the Hurricane Irma, which is scheduled to hit Florida Sunday morning. Now, I just read that it's been downsized to a Category 3. It was originally a Category 5 as it hit Cuba. We don't really know how much damage Cuba has been inflicted on, but we do know some of the smaller Caribbean islands were just hammered. Horrific wind and turbulent rain. So our thoughts and prayers go out to those of you in southern Florida. Hopefully most people have evacuated. But, you know, it's funny. If you look at the hurricane season, this year, unlike most others, is really filled with hurricanes. There's another hurricane right behind Irma, which is Hurricane Jose, which is only a Category 1, but it's building up a lot of energy. And Katia, which is a smaller hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico Ocean, is another Category 1. And we haven't seen hurricanes like this since 2010, 7 years ago, when we had three small hurricanes. Two of them landed in the continental U.S., and one of them was in Florida. But this is odd, and you have to think about global warming, and I'll tell you why. We really got to start thinking about our planet. On Thursday, the 7th, just north of Oaxaca, an 8.1 earthquake hit Mexico. And this is that's a serious earthquake. If we had an 8.1 earthquake in San Francisco, that would wreak havoc. The Loma Prieta, I think, was in the sevens, the low sevens. That was in 1989. An 8.1 would topple most of the buildings in San Francisco and would probably collapse the freeways and then a number of areas, as well as take a lot of life. So poor Mexico. I mean, 428 homes destroyed, over many thousands of others heavily damaged. You know, we have to begin thinking about our environment. Is this global warming? It's hard to say. I'm really on the fence about global warming. I've read and listened to scientists on both sides of the fence. I think human beings are a big influence. And when you look at the amount of carbon monoxide that cars put out and the coal that's still used, it's devastating. I mean, we just had a heat wave here in the Bay Area with unprecedented numbers, triple digits for weeks on, going, you know, some areas as high as 116, close, not in the valley. We're talking about on the coast, which is unheard of. So got to begin thinking about that. Again, you know, my thoughts and prayers go out to those of you in Florida. Let's hope this passes quickly. We just had Harvey land in Houston, and they're still, you know, bailing the water, and it's going to be years for them to recover. So, boy, a lot of weather systems that are affecting us. On a personal note, I have been reviewing an article I wrote back in January on a group of sphinxes that I viewed at the Louvre in Paris when I was there this winter. And the article is called Curiosities from Paris, an Asian Sphinx at the Louvre. And it made me think, actually, of the series that John Anthony West and Robert Schoch developed back in 1993. It's an Emmy Award-winning series, or actually it's a single documentary called Mystery of the Sphinx. And I bring that up because West actually goes out and brings in a forensic artist to look at the Great Sphinx in the Giza Plateau. And a forensic artist basically looks at the construction of the head, the various features of the original design. And when he was done with his sketch, based on the what was left of the face, he believed strongly that the original design was African-centric individual. And a lot of people were like, incredulous about that, because they thought it was one of the, you know, known pharaohs, Khafre, or one of the later dynastic pharaohs. So when this forensic artist came up with an African face, it was a bit of a shock, but I remember it quite distinctly. And when I was in the Louvre, these sphinxes, there's six of them, were fairly, you know, unusual. What was really interesting is as I came around and I first observed these sphinxes, they're small. They're probably about 6 feet long by maybe, I want to say 3.5 feet high, maybe 2.5 feet wide. And they were part of the Serapeum in Egypt. And apparently, we do know some information about this. There were originally 600 of these small sphinx, and it looks like they were dedicated to various individuals. Well, the six Asian sphinx that we see in the Louvre are very, very curious. And in this early article that I wrote, I actually questioned why Egyptologists do not bring up this information. Why don't we talk about the ethnic backgrounds of some of these sphinxes? And it's not, I've discovered that it's not just at the Louvre. There is evidence throughout Egypt of Asian features on a number of large sphinx. So this is leading me to consider another article for Ancient Origins. I think it's going to be my September article on types of sphinxes. And because the Egyptian artists really do an excellent job at reproducing the facial characteristics of specific individuals. And the six people, individuals who are reproduced in sphinxes are very distinct, very unique looking. You can see the article on the Facebook page. I actually posted it earlier in the week. I also had the full article on the earthancients.com page. You can just go to my blog and read all about it. But this is something that really is quite bothersome for me, why Egyptologists do not discuss the different ethnic backgrounds. I think we get into the term diffusion when we start bringing in different parts of the world into one area. Diffusion is something that most academics are not happy about. When I say diffusion, that means that these are cultures, very noted cultures like the Maya, like the Egyptians, dynastic Egyptians, possibly and very likely exchanging information, exchanging technology. We know that in Indonesia, there are very similar pyramids to the Mayan pyramids in Central America. The Mayanist and academic, the true noted Mayanist is Michael Cole. He recently said that he, if he had his chance to do it again, he would, of course, he's 86. He's at the end of his, I mean, he's still paying attention to this, but what he says is that he would have liked to have spent more time studying Indonesian cultures as they relate to the complexes that he researched and wrote extensively about in Central America, specifically the Maya. So, but here we are in Egypt with a kind of a similar situation where we have African-centric, we have Asian, and who knows what other cultures blending in dynastic Egypt. So it's something to consider. I'd like to hear more from these academics on why we see these features, why we see these sphinxes like this, and what it means. You know, I mean, you got to break out of the shell of living in the past. And this is really a big issue for me regarding Egyptology. So look for that article. I'll mention it next week. I don't know what the title is yet, but I am going to take aspects of the article that I wrote for the Facebook page, Earth Ancients. Again, the article's on my website. I have a lot of photos too, so it's kind of interesting to check out. Hey, I'm really excited about my upcoming trip to Mexico. We're going to be in the Yucatan Peninsula from October 28th through November 4th. And I was just talking to a friend who's in Mérida. My mentor, Humbats Men, who was a Mayan elder, passed away late last year, and his son is still at his institute there in Mérida, as well as some other people. And I was just asking him how things are, and they're all looking forward to seeing us down there. So if you get a chance, come down with me. October 28th, we'll be flying into Mérida to meet. We'll have our dinner, and then the next day, the first of 7 individual visits to different ruins, museums, all things Maya for, actually, it's the holidays, because that's coming up for Halloween for us in the States and Day of the Dead in Mexico. But here's a little more about this tour. Yucatan, Mexico is the home to many of the world's most magnificent Mayan ruins. On October 28th through November 4th, I'll be leading a small group of people for a 7-day excursion to some of the most beautiful Mayan cities from the ancient past. We'll be based in Mérida, and each day we'll visit a ruin, we'll see museums, we'll experience everything there is to experience from the ancient past of the Maya. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours, and you'll see the entire program. It's a spectacle not to be missed. So we have just a couple of places left, and if you can do it, you know, come out and join me. This is going to be a personal up close tour. We're going to be climbing a lot of buildings and pyramids that are not typically allowed. You're allowed to climb on. We want to do that because Yucatan is the home of kind of the original early generations of the Maya, and these buildings are sitting on top of geomagnetic fields. Some of them, like Delio at Chichen Itza, are sitting on top of cenotes under rivers and connecting, and this is energetics are surging up into the pyramids. You know, we don't know how they used these energetics. We know just a little bit from people like John Burke, who actually tested geomagnetic fields that came up through these pyramid complexes that the Maya built. So they had and appear to have had science behind this tapping geomagnetic fields. My guess is that they also designed and built their pyramids around these naturally occurring telluric fields and were able to capture it. How they used it is really something to consider. We don't know. But it's probably something that in the near future, scientists are going to be able to figure out. We have rudimentary technology to be able to measure these fields, things like magnometers that can test field energy. I'm going to bring down a very rudimentary magnometer when we're on this tour so we can test some of the buildings. I haven't been down in about 7 years, so that's why I'm interested. That's why I want to go down. I really want to get down there. Have a great time. So come on out and join me if you can. earthancients.com/tours. And hey, really a good price too. Probably the best price you're ever going to see. It's actually half of what normally is paid. Hey, as a reminder, next week, my guest is an author who has written a new book on Samoan pyramids. And these are very rare. This author has discovered this, and she has gone through the history of the oral traditions of Samoa. These pyramids have really not been documented, and this is a chance to hear about them firsthand from an explorer who actually touched ground and was in Samoa for a number of weeks, actually as up to quite a long time, to document Samoan pyramids. So that's next week on Earth Ancients.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And in the news, it looks like tsunamis are coming up again. Here's new evidence in England of a tsunami that devastated Cornwall about 1,000 years ago. Apparently, there's new ground evidence of massive stones and surface damage that occurred in 1018 AD. And what makes this quite unique is that they don't believe it was an earthquake. They actually think it was an asteroid hit in the Atlantic that caused this tsunami. Now, this is interesting simply because I reported last week that there was a tsunami, evidence of tsunami in ancient Rome. And I had reported months ago of a major tsunami hit about 1,500 years ago, 1,500 years ago in Central America, on the Yucatan Peninsula, that came in about almost 50 miles, which really means that it destroyed everything in its path. And these tsunamis are devastating. And the fact that they can track them is fascinating. I think they're becoming, people are becoming more aware of them. Scientists are looking for evidence of them. And the fact that it's a possible asteroid strike that would cause this is something else to consider for our present day. Now, in recent memory, we haven't had an asteroid hit our planet that we know of, but this is something to consider. If the ancients dealt with them, you know, what are the effects of an asteroid hit today? So it's really something to consider. New evidence discovered at a burial site in Sweden in the town of Birka. It looks like women were trained as professional fighters and honored at their death. There's a large burial that was discovered in the late 1800s, and they've reviewed the woman who was buried over 1,000 years ago, and it appears that women fought side by side with the men in various battles. They traveled with them to battle scenes, and these Viking women were as well trained as the men. So it makes you think that is quite an interesting society to train women and train women. I mean, it's something we do today in our armed services. So, wow, that's pretty cool. That article is in Facebook. You can check it out, and it's from a UK magazine. One of our contributors, Hakum Agan, who is in Turkey, he's been a regular contributor of ours, has sent some new photographs. Apparently, they have discovered pyramids in Nicaragua, the jungle portion of that area. It's a jungle called Canta Gallo, And basically, these are massive stone pyramids formed and carved from existing volcanic and andesite stone. And they're made up of these very long volcanic rocks. They're like piers, long stones, and they're stacked. And he found a series of photographs that I've posted on the Facebook page. We're going to have Hakeem on the program next week to talk a little bit about not only these Nicaraguan pyramids, but also some ancient sites that he has been posting on our Facebook page that are located in various parts of Turkey. Turkey is very, very old, ancient, and there are a number of fascinating sites that he's going to talk to us about. So stay tuned for that next week. Nicaraguan pyramid. The ancient unknown head of a pharaoh has been uncovered in the city of Hazar, which is in northern Israel. Scientists are curious as to who this pharaoh is. They don't have a clue. There's no record of a pharaoh in that part of Israel. It's dated that the pharaoh's head is dated to over 4,300 years old. And what they found at a site, at a burial site, was the fragments of a head. And it appears that it was destroyed. It was crushed. And they pieced it back together. And it's a beautiful piece of sculpture. Why it was destroyed in that fashion, it's hard to say. Who this individual was, who this pharaoh was, is no one. No one has an idea. But you can see the entire story on the Facebook page. By the way, I have a huge series of photos of pharaoh's head. That's a it's a megalithic head. It must weigh probably in the neighborhood of 20 tons. They just uncovered it in Luxor. It's a huge, huge, huge head. In fact, they tried to cover it up with to keep it from being exposed to the elements before, so they could treat it. Let's see. They're not sure who it is, but the photographs that I posted on Facebook really are quite amazing. And how they carved this thing with such detail is something to really consider. They were master craftsmen at carving this thing. It's about... I want to say about 20 feet tall. It's laying on its side. The nose is massive. It must have been, they're estimating it must have been at least 35 to 40 feet high. It's huge, 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 huge. Check it out with all the other material on Earth Ancients. Go to Facebook. Yeah, you can go to Earth Ancients and see it there, but go to Facebook. Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and you can see all the weekly articles. Each day, people post on that, so check it out. So now it's time to check in with Melissa Tittle from Gaia to find out what is happening this week in the catalog of new releases from Gaia, one of the best streaming media resources out there. So here's Melissa. So we're checking back with Melissa, and we want to know what's happening this week in the Gaia selection of programs. So, hey, Melissa, how you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about our friend that we all know very well, Michael Cremo, and apparently Regina Meredith is... featuring him on her Open Minds program. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Michael, I feel like Michael Cremo is one of those legends. Forbidden Archaeology have been like a very famous book, and he's definitely has helped push the envelope for many years, and so having him as a guest on Regina is just an ode to that. I think specifically he talks about the Kali Yuga in this episode, but his knowledge of all different types of sites is very important, I think. Right. Michael Cremo, I interviewed for the new series, Ancient Civilizations, that's coming out October 2nd. So we just made sure that we got as much from him as possible. And there is talks of hopefully doing something with him in the future.
He is he's an encyclopedia of anomalous information about our past. And I've read his book and looked at his books are monstrous research pieces, and fantastic. So the Open Minds with Regina is actually coming out today, the 7th, and will be available, I would imagine. Very cool stuff. So we'll definitely promote that once we get going on it. Okay, Melissa, thank you, and you have
okay.
a great weekend.
All right. You too. Thank you.
And you cannot believe how much material, how many new programs are now listed on Gaia. And if you want to check it out, there is a 99-cent special for the first month. I mean, take the loose change out of your pocket and fire it over to those guys. To get this the program to start, it's Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. That's the landing page. You can kind of sense some of the topics. They have a great series on pyramids. They have the details on sacred geometry. I mean, pretty much everything we feature here on Earth Ancients, the hundreds of topics cover here, there is a content to support it on Gaia. So when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. They're our sponsor. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. This week, author William Carlson introduces his new book, Jungle of Stone. It's the story of the rediscovery of the Maya following the Spanish conquest of Central America. And two explorers travel through some of the most desolate parts of Mexico and uncover the ancient Maya. Fascinating story. I hope you'll enjoy it. So as many of you know, I have a great fascination with Central American culture, in specifically the Maya. And I ran across a book a few months ago, actually maybe a little longer, called Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. And the author is William Carlson, and I wanted to talk to Bill about his book because it's the story of John Lloyd Stephens and Frederick Catherwood, who, through their journeys through Central America, basically revealed to the world the Maya, this amazing culture that up until that point had been not really known. I mean, there had been evidence and ruin news of ruins throughout Central America. And this book, Jungle of Stone, is a wonderful, not only chronicle of their travels, but really tells us a lot about the two men who, through trial and tribulation, made their way up from the southernmost tip of Central America into Guatemala, Honduras, and eventually into the Yucatan Peninsula. So I'm really quite pleased to have William Carlson with us for this program. And I'm looking forward to quite an interesting interview. Bill, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
This book is quite interesting. You really went to work on each of these individuals, Stevens and Catherwood, and you break ground on a lot of areas that we're going to talk about. But I have to ask you: you lived in Guatemala with your wife for quite a bit of time. Were you? Why would you live in Guatemala? I mean, I haven't been down there, but was it because of work? Was it retirement? What was the? You were in Antigua, which is a somewhat of a sprawling area, but what was the purpose of living in Guatemala?
Well, originally I went down with my wife to study Spanish. Antigua is a colonial town outside of Guatemala City, about an hour drive from Guatemala City, but quite removed from it by the mountains. It was originally the capital of Central America during the Spanish colonial time, and it's a World Heritage Site, cobblestone streets, beautiful old buildings, a lot of ruins because of the earthquakes they have down there, and they have something like 40 Spanish language schools that are immersive. It means, you know, you go in and you start speaking Spanish right away, one-on-one tutors.
Right.
And so you really get into the Spanish. So we went down there to do that, and we just fell in love with the place. It's surrounded by volcanoes. It's 5,000 feet in the mountains. It's called the Land of Eternal Spring, and which means it's in the 70s year-round, hard to beat. And it was founded by the conquistadors, the Spanish conquistadors. And so I just we fell in love with it. We built a house down there, and we just loved it. We no longer have it, but we stayed down there for 20 years. But we were both working in San Francisco. I was a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. So we went down. We took a couple leaves of absence, and we took our vacation time and went down there.
So it was like a getaway, is what you're saying. It was like another home. You weren't there full time. Obviously, you couldn't have been if you were.
No, we were working people.
Yeah, exactly.
So
fascinating.
But we still have a lot of friends down there, and we were down there this year again, visiting with people, and it's
fantastic.
A wonderful place. And
how,
from there,
how
of course,
that...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
From there, it's an easy jump off to some of the ruins. In Copan, in Honduras, Tikal, and so on.
Yeah.
So it's a great place to go if you're interested in going out to the ruins.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's a great area. I wanted to mention to our listeners that you were a reporter for 2 decades at the San Francisco Chronicle, and you were a finalist in 1999 for a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. Was that a specific article you wrote about a subject matter that was highlighted?
It's kind of off point, but it was a series of stories another reporter and I did. Took us about 6 months about needle sticks and among health workers in the United States and how they transmit diseases like hepatitis C and even HIV. And it was an expose, and ended up changing the laws, and first in the state of California and then in the federal government, as to how these things can be controlled and remedied. And so it had a big impact. And then we did a second six-month piece on how our needles are reused in the developing world, and all the time they're reused. Again, spreading disease.
When you say needles, what do you mean by needles? You mean
syringes.
Like sewing needles?
No, syringes.
Syringes. Oh.
Syringes.
Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah, syringes.
Oh.
Right.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're talking probably people who have an addiction and are using needles and they exchange needles.
Medically. Mostly for medical reasons, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
So that's what it was about, yeah.
Okay.
Guatemala.
Yeah,
actually.
No, I'm always interested in, sure. in you know, to be acknowledged for something like that is an honor, and your story was significant enough for them to really take a close look at your work. So that's fantastic. In the acknowledgments of your book, you actually mention Edwin Shook, who is a noted Mayan archaeologist, and in this acknowledgement, you were able to see some original Catherwood colored original views from his book. I think it's called Views of Ancient Monuments. Would you say that was a turning point in your interest in those two?
You know, actually, it was a combination of things, kind of a perfect storm. I had become fascinated with the Mayan ruins by living in Guatemala and visiting them. That was kind of the basis of it all. But I got to know Ed pretty well. In fact, we used to play poker together. He was in retirement. He did the original excavation project for Tikal in Guatemala. And so, yes, that was a part of it. But the other part was at the University of California, Berkeley, there is a library, the Bancroft Library, which is an historical scholar library for history of the Western United States and the Americas. And I found out that I read John L. Stevens' books that he and Catherwood had done. Catherwood had done the illustrations, and Stevens wrote the books about their adventures and their journey through and the discovery of the Maya. And then a year later, someone told me that, I forget how I found out, I think I found out online, in fact, that Stevens' personal papers, his letters and so on, were at the Bancroft Library at Berkeley. And at this point, I had retired from the Chronicle, and I was teaching journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism in Berkeley. So it was very convenient for me to go over from the journalism school right over to the Bancroft Library and pour through Stevens' letters. And in fact, there was a contract I held in my hands. It was quite, you know, it's one of those moments that Stevens, who was a lawyer, wrote up for Catherwood, contracting him to come along and do the illustrations for this possible discovery. They didn't know if there was going to be anything. But there was the contract, the original contract that Stevens drew up, and how much money he was going to pay him and support his wife while they were gone, and so on. It was very, very interesting. So that was really, really the turning point, was when I started to read his personal papers and letters with Catherwood later, because we became great friends. And then I found out that there was only one biography of each man written by the same author, Van Hagen, in the 1940s, and it was quite out of date. So everything just came together. It was like, well, and Van Hagen didn't have access to these papers. And so I just plunged in and started doing research I followed their entire path. That was another great thing, because we kept the old beat up 1985 Toyota Corolla down there in Antigua. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do a book on them, I should see what they saw 160 years later, to be sure. But, you know, follow their path. Where did they land in Guatemala? Where did they go first? Where did they go next? And so I followed their entire path, about 2,700 miles. And it was an incredible experience. I went at the same time of the year that they were there. As you know, Cliff, you know, the seasons down there, there's a rainy season, dry season.
Oh, boy.
You know.
Yeah.
And they went down in October. They thought they had just missed the rainy season. Well, they got caught up in it. But I went at the same time of year to experience the same kind of climate and the humidity and the rain and the temperature, and followed their entire path through the jungle in my old beat-up Toyota Corolla. So it was really quite an experience. I ended up all the way in circling through from their landing in Guatemala to Honduras, Copan, through Guatemala, back to into Mexico and Chiapas to various places, ended up in Palenque, and then on up to Uxmal and the places Chichen Itza and Tulum. So I did the whole circuit, and it was.
I mean, I read that. I read that in your book, and that's one of the early things I wanted to bring up is that I mean, for those of you listening, the books we're referring to is called Incidents of Travel in Central America. There was a follow-up by John Lloyd Stevens called Incidents of Travel in Yucatan, which was the second book. But you actually took the 2,000-plus mile trek. Now, you must have followed roads close to where they went, because obviously they're traveling in the jungle, but you basically started in what is now Guatemala City and followed their travels right up into Yucatan. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, no, I actually went up to the place they landed. They sailed from New York in 1839.
Right.
They sailed out of New York, and it's interesting, they sailed right into the teeth of, you know, the hurricane season, because we know we're going through it right now.
Right.
They were unbelievable then, you know. I mean, they had only had sailing ships. Steamships hadn't really come about by that time. And so they sailed down from New York City, landed in Belize first, and then they went up what's called the Rio Dulce River, which is kind of like the heart of darkness, you know, in Africa, you know, the great book by Joseph Conrad. And they sailed up this river, Rio Dulce, into a big lake called Lake Isabel, and landed at a little town called Isabel. And that was the place where all the trade from the Atlantic came through, this little tiny port town of Isabel. So I drove up to that point and started at that point.
Okay.
And then followed their trail from where they first entered Central America.
Before we get into some of the meat of this book, I wanted to ask you, can you describe a little bit of this partnership? I mean, these guys were in close quarters for months on end. What makes Stevens and Catherwood so special to be able to turn around these? I mean, Catherwood was a brilliant illustrator. Stevens was a good writer. He had success before in his travels throughout the Middle East, and had been very successful in his book. But what makes those two so compatible?
I think it was their kind of insatiable curiosity about the past. They had both separately gone. Catherwood grew up in London. He was British.
Right.
He had studied architecture in Rome and in Greece. Stevens came from New York. He was a lawyer in New York. He didn't like practicing the law. He practiced it for about 10 years, and he really didn't enjoy it at all. And so both separately were just so fascinated by the ancient civilizations in the Middle East, both the Romans and the Greeks and the Egyptians. And so they were drawn to the Middle East and up the Nile, for example, on expeditions. Catherwood joined in various expeditions illustrating many of the Egyptian ruins along the Nile. Stevens went on his own. Up the Nile and through the Holy Land, Jerusalem, and so on. But they almost covered the same ground. And then when they were in New York, Stevens came back to New York, wrote a book about his travels, which were incredible bestsellers. He was just an amazing writer. so vivid, and he just captured the adventure of what he had done. And Cato, by this point, had come to New York with his family, his wife and children, from London, to open up what was then called a roundabout or a panorama. Back then, they didn't have video, they didn't have, didn't even have photography. So if you wanted to experience something like the ruins of Egypt or Jerusalem or even the Battle of Waterloo, they would put together these gigantic canvases in a 360-degree roundabout, and you would enter and you'd stand in the middle, and you could turn around and you would be in the middle of Jerusalem. You'd see the whole thing. So Catherwood was a kind of a businessman and an artist, so he was he built a panorama right off of Broadway in Manhattan, in New York, and in 1836-37. And it was a going enterprise. And then he hooked up with Stevens. Stevens went to the panorama, and he said, "What? Oh, this is amazing, you know, what I saw in Egypt and what I saw in Jerusalem." And they became fast friends.
Fascinating.
They were bound by this incredible curiosity about the past. And so when they heard there were rumors, essentially, of stones, carved stones in the jungles of Central America, they thought, well, you know, they just had this, I think they were infected, really, almost. Mm-hmm. It was almost like a virus, you know. They couldn't contain themselves. They said, well, we got to go down there and see. You know, we don't know what's there. No one knows really what's there, but we have to do this. And Cather would put the panorama in the hands of his partner. He had a partner, and sent his wife and kids back to England to stay with his mother. And then Stevens wrote up the contract, and off they went. So that's how they got it together. They're very different men. That was what's so interesting is Stevens was very voluble, very gregarious. He loved to talk. He loved to tell stories, a raconteur. He was just, and it all shows in his writing. And Cather was, you know, the British stiff upper lip, very private, very reserved guy. And there were, you know, Cather was 5 years older than Stevens and taller, and Stevens had this red beard, and they had different personalities. They looked different, but they shared this one common interest, and it was enough to carry them through unbelievable hardship. I mean, that's the big part of the book, you know.
Yeah, is not only disease and pestilence, but just they basically arrived when there was warring going on, and just really a tough situation. How old were they when they arrived?
Stevens was about 30. Let's see, he was born in 1805, and they left in, so he's 34.
Okay.
And Catherwood was about 5 years older, so he's a little later, in late 30s.
Okay.
But they had tremendous courage because they knew that there was a bloody civil war going on in Central America among what are now the states of, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, El Salvador, and so on. They were all bound together at that time by a common republic. But there was a civil war breaking them all up. And Stevens knew this, and so did Catherwood, right, that they were going to go right into the teeth of this bloody civil war. And Stevens got himself appointed by the then president, U.S. President Martin Van Buren, as the diplomat, the U.S. diplomat to Central America, thinking this would provide them with great cover, you know, that they now they had some official capacity and so on. Well, it didn't help them much. I mean, within 2 weeks, they were taken hostage by some angry villagers that thought they were on the other side and, you know, under gunpoint and so on. But they talked their way out of it, and it's all part of the adventure story. I mean, it's just an amazing story, really.
It is. You write in your book that they followed in the very beginning, perhaps the route that Cortez had taken into the first, maybe the first portion of their travel. But what was their route? Was it just listening to locals saying this is where there's some stone buildings, and then kind of just going along on a path? Because in the back of your book, and this is a really smart thing, you have on the jacket the actual routes they take upon landing, and it's pretty arduous.
Yeah, well, that's the hardbound book that came out about a year ago, but the paperback, yeah, by the way, came out a couple months ago, and the same map is in the paperback. It's inside, but
okay,
yeah, it was they had gathered enough information that they knew that there was some kind of ruins in the little town of Copan.
Right.
And so they wanted to land. They landed in the traditional place you would land in Guatemala if you were going to Honduras,
mm-hmm,
this town of Izabal. But that was very close to the border with Honduras. And initially, they were on their way directly to Guatemala City because Stevens had this obligation, this duty, to take over not the embassy, but it was a small office and so on in Guatemala City for the U.S. Consular and diplomatic,
right,
office. But on the way there, they were told, you can't go there. If you go down this road, which is the main road from Izabal, all the trade went down this road, you'll be killed because there's bandits and there's the rebels, the Indians, uprising against the government. You know, mm-hmm, it's just totally treacherous. You'll never make it to Guatemala City. So in a way, they said, okay, all right, well, we know over here in Honduras is this place called Copan. They didn't really know where it was, you know, and there really weren't great maps at the time, but they asked around, and so they detoured to Copan. That wasn't really their first intention. The first intention was for Stevens to finalize a trade agreement with the Republic of Central America and get his work out of the way, and then they would go exploring. But mm-hmm, so they just detoured, and it was very close, so they detoured over to Copan, and that's the first ruins they found. And when they did, I mean, it blew their minds. They,
yes,
could not believe what they found. They couldn't believe it. And in the book, you know, it's a lot of illustrations, as you've seen, Cliff. A lot of them by Catherwood, mm-hmm, of course. And I went, of course, in my trip, I took a lot of photos. And so in the book, we've put the photos next to Catherwood's original drawings from, mm-hmm, 160 years ago. And you can see these monuments, these huge 14-foot Stella,
yeah,
these incredible figures, and they just couldn't believe when they encountered these, and the pyramids and the palaces, all, of course, overgrown in the jungle in Copan. The town was just like four or five huts.
Yeah.
And the people in the town just ignored these. They ignored it. They thought, oh, the stones out there, who knows what they didn't know anything about them. They just...
You have an interesting description in the early part of your book when they come to Copan. And Catherine Wood was a trained illustrator. I mean, he had done, you know, numerous works. He could see and reproduce works of high quality. But you make an interesting statement. When he came up to one of these stela, of one of these gigantic figures, he was very, very frustrated simply because of the ornate quality of the carving and the sheer size of these things. So he actually had to, in some ways, the way you describe it, would you say he had to kind of relearn a technique of reproducing these pieces?
Well, that's true. I mean, it was incomprehensible for them at first. And when you see these monuments in Copan and all over these ruins, you pretty much get the idea, and you certainly get the idea in the book because of the illustrations and the photos. It's just the ornateness of the carvings and the depth of the carvings. So they had to cut down the forest. They hired local people, and they cut down the trees so enough light could come in that would, you know, in the sculpture of the stone, would highlight the features to the extent that he could see them and never understand them. I mean, it was just incomprehensible. But and then, of course, these gigantic monuments were covered in hieroglyphics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Cathy Wood, with incredible accuracy, reproduced these monuments and the things that they found in his illustrations, so much so that some of these things have been lost to time, worn out, robbed and looted by tomb raiders, and so on, that they actually can go now, because they have broken the Maya code about 40, 50 years ago, and they can read those hieroglyphics off of the illustrations that Cathcart Wood achieved, and he did it with such accuracy.
And that's one of the things I wanted to really think that's fantastic about your book, Bill, is that you just mentioned this. You compare his illustrations to the photographs, and they're very well, they're very accurate to the point of almost being photorealistic. I mean, he did such a great job.
Right.
So.
And, you know, both of these men had been to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And in case of Cathcart Wood, studied the Egyptian runes. And he knew the hieroglyphics, and so did Stevens. And what they saw there, this was the beginning of their understanding. It was, you know, this first flush of finding this was mind-blowing. You know, it's just awesome to them. They couldn't put it all together. But it was the first, it was the beginning of them understanding that, you see, up until this time, this is a really important theme of the book, was up until this time, all of the research of the ruins that had been found, and Planky had been discovered by the Spanish, and they'd been writing about it. And so Planky in Chiapas, Mexico, a fantastic Maya site, one of the most beautiful sites of all the Maya, had been discovered, had been written about. The Spanish had repressed all that because they never wanted anyone outside of Spain to know about this stuff. Was starting to come out in the early 1800s. And there was some scholarly work in Paris and so on in England. And they all thought if there was anything like this that had any kind of civilization buried in the jungles, that it had to be from the Egyptians or the Phoenicians or the Carthaginians, had come across long before Columbus, had made their way to the New World, had settled here, and that must be what the ruins are about, because obviously the Indians, the Native American Indians, were incapable. They were savages.
Yes.
They were barbarians. They were incapable of anything, any full flush of civilization. They couldn't have done that. So the most important thing that Stevens and Cathcart Wood did, aside from essentially creating American archaeology, long before, you know, the word even existed, was to essentially blow up this whole idea. And by the time they finished their two books and their two journeys and had gone to 44 cities, you know, discovered 44 cities. They had pieced together this vast civilization that had in common all the hieroglyphics, variations of architecture, of course, but it had come to the conclusion that this was indigenous. This was from the original, the Indians, in America. The Native American Indians were able to do this. And so that was the great breakthrough that they created in their journeys and in their writings. And they they couldn't keep the books in print. People waited for the books, the next book to come out. They were the bestsellers of their time, all the way in England. Queen Victoria wanted a copy. I mean, they were just all over. So,
and you just made a very, very good point in that when these illustrations came out, the science at the time immediately thought, well, is this Hindu, this is Roman, this is Greek. These are not native people. And I think your point is that through the writings, through the evidence of these actual cities, that these artifacts, these relief sculptures, were part of a native people known as the Maya, and that basically changed our understanding of the Maya as a civilization, which I find fascinating.
Exactly. And you know, they were in an unusual position to make that judgment because they had been to the old world civilizations. Mm-hmm. They had been to Greece, Rome, and Egypt, and they had seen those for themselves, and so they could see that this was entirely different. This had grown up entirely separate from the old world for 15,000 years, ever since they came across the Bering Strait and the Western Hemisphere was populated by the Indians. So there was no contact at all. This was an entirely unique, original civilization. And so that's what they found, and that's the significance of that discovery.
One thing you describe in the book, and I want your opinion about this, is that the Spanish conquest of Central America was brutal. And you describe cities being destroyed, monuments, idols were destroyed. We know about Diego de Landa, as well as many, many other padres and priests destroying literally piles of records, books. We know now some of these were technical manuals. It doesn't really, you don't get into the specifics of it, but did you read in some of Stephen's reports that there was great evidence of this damage, of this, for lack of a purpose of words, perhaps a genocide?
No. In fact, I don't think that they were, you know, this came much later. Those discoveries came a lot later. I don't think that Stevens and Catherwood were aware. I mean, you know, there was history books that were talking about, there were kind of anti-Spanish books that had come out, and they were aware of those, that that the Spanish had treated the Indians horribly, had, you know, destroyed, they had destroyed Montezuma and the Aztec, pyramids and so on. So that was known, but in his writings and in the papers that I saw, there was really no discussion of that. I, of course, made the point in the book that that's what happened as a context and as a background to lead up to of what they, you know, their journey and their expedition, and what, you know, I mean, really, at one point, I mean, when Columbus came over, within 150 years, the population of the Western Hemisphere, which was at that time considered to be about 10 million, I mean, 100 million people in the whole Western Hemisphere, which was, now they think was reduced by 90%.
Yeah.
And most of that was from smallpox and disease. A small part of that, of course, was, you know, labor, working people to death on these plantations and so on, and the brutality of the wars that the Spanish visited on these tribes and these people that were there. But, you know, it's a deficit. It was genocide. It was one of the worst things that, you know, it's well known now. But I did that in the book as a way of background, of course. But I don't think they were aware of that.
Yeah. Cortez was brutal, as well as the other conquistadors that came to the other parts of Central America. I want to ask you a little bit, and you bring this up. They both of Catherwood and Stephen spent a period of time in Palenque, And why did they find Palenque so unique? Was it just the buildings? Because at that time they probably had to cut away quite a bit of the forest around these buildings to get at the structures themselves. I'm just curious, why did they find that so interesting?
Well, Palenque is truly one of the greatest. When I say greatest, I mean one of the almost the epitome of Mayan art. And it was the kind of art, it was very different from Copan. Copan had these gigantic stela where the engravings were very deep. You know, they were very sculpted out in great depth. And what happened with the Maya is they really worked where they were with the stone that they had. And so the stone around Honduras and Copan was a lot softer, and they were able to sculpt it in a way, so they worked with that. Now, when they got to Palenque, all the way on the other side of the Yucatan Peninsula and over in Chiapas, the stone they have there is extremely hard, beautiful limestone.
Mm-hmm.
And so the artists of Palenque were ingenious at doing bas relief carvings in this very fine limestone. And they were so meticulous, and they, you know, everything that the Maya did was painted. And they, you know, so the pyramids were painted as bright reds and yellows, and the monuments were all painted. They would actually carve these figures on the sides of the buildings in Palenque, and then, like, dress them with undercoats of I guess we'd call it underwear now, you know. And then they put more plaster on top of that and carve that. They were so meticulous. And so the carvings were so stunning. And the hieroglyphs there were, they had, there's a call of the Temple of Inscriptions. You go up to the top of the temple and there's these gigantic tablets of inscriptions.
Right.
And Catherwood took down every single one of them. He replicated every single one of those hieroglyphs. They had no idea what they were saying, you know, but they thought maybe in the future someone will be able to understand what this is. And so they did plaster because they had all this limestone that they could work with as, limestone, plaster of Paris, you know, essentially. And so it was very different than Copan, and they each had their own beauty. That's the amazing thing about the Maya. The Maya were a phenomenal civilization. Up in the Yucatan, it was different as well.
Yeah.
Different styles and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had achieved so much, the Maya. You know, they understood the stars, astronomy. They had gigantic calendars, cycles of time. They had their own creation myths. You know, and they made these gigantic pyramids and cities. They didn't have the wheel, and they didn't have any kind of metallic tools. They used hard rock, obsidian, and so on to be able to carve these things. So it was really amazing civilization, and it lasted for an enormous length of time.
Right.
From 200 BC or even before, the pre-Maya, but to 900 AD. Longer than Greece, longer than Rome, longer than, I think it might have been longer than any coherent civilization that humans have created. So they were phenomenal.
When they were finished with Palenque, forever, whatever reasons, what was their next place of journey? This is what I'm trying to figure out. Is how they managed to get all the way back up to Yucatan. Was it always their idea, their plan, to start in Guatemala and go all the way up to Yucatan?
Well, they had to start in Guatemala after Stevens reported back to the United States
right.
that there was no government. He had been chasing the government around for 3 months, and it was falling apart, and you know, there was a huge battle, and in Guatemala City, and the rebels won and destroyed the republic. And but he was there witnessing all of this. By the way, it's part of the book. So when they realized, okay, we're done here now, you know, he wrote his last dispatch to the Secretary of State, Forsyth in Washington, and packed up all of the papers of the delegation and the legate, and now they were free. At Stevens' expense, to start their exploration. So at that point, they had already discovered Copan. They had discovered another place near Copan with huge monuments called Kirigua. And now they set out for Palenque, because Palenque was well known. So they crossed Guatemala and saw various ruins along the way, Ocosinco as well in Mexico, and then they finally got to Palenque. And they knew about Uxmal as well, because that had been reported about. So they were kind of driven by these vague reports ahead of them. And as they went, they would also meet people, Native Americans as well as Spanish colonial people, that would tell them, well, you know, you're looking for stones? Well, there's, you know, a mile out this way, you know, there's some stones, carved stones. You might want to take a look. We don't know much about them, but go on, you know. They went on mules. Everything was by mule. That's why I always loved 1985 Toyota Corolla, because it was the closest thing I could come up with to a mule. We had no air conditioning, no radio. You know, it was like I wanted to suffer as much as I could. But anyway, that's how they eventually made it up to Uxmal. But you see, what you have to understand is they were constantly battling snakes, mosquitoes, and the heat, and malaria. You know, they both had malaria, bout after bout of malaria. They were sick at least a quarter to half of the time. I mean, really sick. Yeah. And yet they pushed on, and they pushed on. But finally, when they got up to Uxmal, which is in Yucatan, they went out to the ruins at Uxmal, and they were so excited to see it, except that Catherwood was so sick that he was near death. And Stephen said, I can't do this. We can't do this. I got to. And they carried him on a stretcher, night and day, all the way back to the coast. And they got on a ship to get back to New York so he could recover. And he did, of course. And then, you know, a year later, after they printed did the first book, they couldn't help themselves. They went back. They knew what they were getting into, but they went back.
Which I find fascinating, because they were both so ill. They were desperate to get the hell off the Yucatan just to get back home. And you have a wonderful passage in the book where they're ready to leave, but their Catherwood is just deathly ill. He sounds like he's just ready to drop. And then they get back on the boat to get back to New York. But then they come back. They come back, which I found was
And, you know, Catherwood was an amazing guy. I mean, Stevens was always going around measuring and, you know, recording the measuring. And they would hire people as they went to, you know, cut down the trees. And so Stevens was doing all that and keeping a notebook, many notebooks, obviously. But Catherwood would stand there, you know, like in the mud. And he would have gloves on while he drew because of the mosquitoes. You know, they would cover themselves as much as they could, mosquitoes and the insects and the ticks. I mean, Stephen's legs were embedded with ticks at one point, and he had to go back to the town outside of Palenque because they were swollen with all these ticks. So I don't even know what there is today that is quite, you know, we have astronauts now, you know, I guess. And now we got people doing X Games. You know, they do the daredevil things. I suppose that's still the impetus that people have. But these guys were. I mean, they were, and they, you know, and they went back. You're right. I mean, they.
Yeah.
Intrepid doesn't even describe it. They were courageous and determined people, guys, and and they. You know, they brought out of the jungle this entire civilization for people to understand and know.
Now, they both spent quite a bit of time in Uxmal, and I've been to Uxmal a number of times. It's one of my favorite ruins simply because of the standing architecture. But not only that, it's just one of the most amazing cities ever conceived, simply because the Maya were geniuses. They have artificial platforms and levels and things like that. But what was the real drive for them to stay there for so long?
Well, part of it was that Stevens would go off on his own and explore neighboring places, while Cather would continue to do the illustrations of Uxmal. And so that took some time. And then Stevens got really sick, and they had to be taken to the village to recover. And then one of the guys that was their, you know, factotum, the guy that did their cooking and so on, that was with them at all times, he got sick, and he had to go back. And when they went back to the second time to the Yucatan, they had a doctor with them. And so there were three of them. So then he got malaria, and he got sick, and he had to go back. And actually, in the end, Catherwood was the only one left in the ruins. And, you know, he was, every day he was out there drawing and drawing and drawing. And finally he got sick. And so it just was this continuum of sickness. And I remember when they got back to the ruins and Catherwood was there, he had set up a pistol with a wire across the mouth of the, they were staying in the governor's palace, and, you know, a tripwire. So, because he was there alone. And, you know, if what, you know, it could be a jaguar coming in, it could be, an Indian that was, who knows, a bandit. So, but then he fell down with, you know, he had another bout of malaria, because it kept coming back, or chronic attacks of malaria that they had, because they would keep getting bitten by the mosquitoes. They didn't know the mosquitoes were causing the malaria. You know, that wasn't discovered until they were building the Panama Canal in the early part of the 1900s. They didn't know. They thought it was the swamp. It called it miasma, the wetness of the swamp. You know, just some kind of like the heavy air. You know, they didn't know it was the mosquitoes. They didn't like the mosquitoes. They were trying to do everything they could to smoke them out and everything else. But they kept getting bitten and bitten, and, you know, one bout after another. So, yeah, they were there quite a while.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about how their lives end in a bit here. But a question I have for you is that I'm looking at the route they took. Was it on Stevens or Catherwood's mind to consider any of the other natives? Because they might have run into evidence of Olmec or some other people in the area, but it doesn't, in the writing that I see of them in both the books, Incidents of Travel, it's fairly focused on the Maya, isn't it?
Well, that's the area they went. The Olmecs were farther north, you know, along the Veracruz coast. And there might have been some artifacts of the Olmecs there. It's conceivable. And they did pick up things, and they brought them back to New York. I mean, they wanted to start a national museum of artifacts of American antiquities, based on what they found and other people, you know, from Native Americans in North America. So they might have encountered some of that, but really the area that they were in was the Maya area. And, you know, the Aztecs were farther north, the Olmec were farther north along the Veracruz coast, farther up the Gulf of Mexico. And so they didn't really encounter those things. I mean, if they had gone over to Oaxaca, you know, they might have found Zapotec artifacts, but they never went that direction. So it's not like they confined themselves to the Maya area. It's just that it worked out that way.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You brought up a very interesting point earlier in that Catherwood's reproductions of standing monuments, of buildings, different artifacts was so accurate that after years of being out in the open, the atmosphere, pollution, perhaps just being exposed to the elements, wreaked havoc on a lot of these structures, monuments, and artifacts, so that he, later scholars are able to really look at that. Do you think that's a problem today still? Because I mean, I've seen images in Copan taken 20 years ago of some of these standing monuments, stela, and things like that, and they seem to be weathering. Is there a consciousness around that now? Do you know?
Oh, there is, for sure. I mean, I could tell you specifically in Copan, and probably many of the other, now that I think of it, they have taken the monuments and replicated them completely. And so the ones that you see sometimes on the site where they actually were are complete replicas. Meanwhile, like Copan comes to mind because they have a terrific museum in Copan. You enter in a tunnel when you go into the museum. And so the originals are in that museum, and they're protected. It's covered. They're protected. And so there's a great effort to protect these. They've covered them now. If you go to a lot of these ruins, you'll see that they've built coverings over them to keep the rain off of them and, you know, the weathering of them so they don't weather and so on. So, yes, there's a very conscious effort to protect these at all costs. You know, it's been gradual, but it's certainly, you know, it's the patrimony of Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, and it's, you know, it's vitally important to them. So, yes, they do, there's a lot of efforts being made to preserve them.
Yeah. Do you think Catherwood and Stevens recognized their achievements before they died, that they had basically revealed to the world this great civilization of the Maya?
Well, it's an interesting thing. When I wrote the epilogue to the book, you know, I think I made the point that they had such hardship. They had been there through these civil wars, these brutal, bloody civil wars. And all this is described in Stevens' books. That, in effect, and he was very conscious when he was going through all this and they were doing this, that others would come behind them, you know, would come after them. But he was so convincing, really, about the hardship, the disease, the brutality in the Yucatan several years after they left was a tremendous uprising by the Mayan Indians against the colonial Spanish. It was incredible, the brutality of that. So that for really quite a while, 20 years, no one wanted to go anywhere near Central America. I mean, I'm talking about scholars now potential archaeologists, amateur archaeologists, and so on. So he was just too convincing. However, 20, 30 years later, started in Europe. Europeans, the British, the French, they started coming. They had Catherwood and Stevens' books. And they started to come, and they had photography then. They started, you know, they came with cameras. And right. So they started to come into all, to follow actually in their paths with the books, with Stephen and Catherwood's books. So they started follow the path and discover more and more and photograph it as well. So, and then that began, you know, this whole, then, you know, the Harvard and University of Pennsylvania and the Carnegie Institute and so on, many of these great institutions and anthropological museums and so on began to send expeditions down there to uncover the ruins, and there's still many, many ruins to uncover of the Maya. They're still making discoveries,
which is amazing. The Mayan elders I speak to say there's tens of thousands of undiscovered ruins. When I hear that, I'm kind of going, you got to be kidding me. But there's so much of Yucatan, and where you were living in Guatemala and Honduras, it's just jungle. So there
right.
could be, I guess. You had to think about it.
Well, at the peak of the Mayan civilization, in an area, it's called the lower rainforest, which is north. There's a lot of mountains in Guatemala, but north of those, it starts to slope down into the plain, which is the Yucatan itself. You know, it's very, very flat. And the slopes of these mountains and these highlands, as they come down, is called the lower tropical forests. There's a big, you can make a big oval circle where Tikal was, Uxistán, I'm thinking of El Mirador, Calakmul, Palenque, those, I'm thinking, they're not coming to me right now. But anyway, there's multiple cities there, including Copan and Palenque, one in the east, Copan in the east, which was the furthest east, and Palenque in the furthest west. And in fact, Stevens didn't know that, but they were at the fringes in the east and the west of the Mayan civilization. You put all that together, there were 10 million people now that they consider was the population of that area. And now, today, there's only about 400,000 or 500,000 people that can live there.
Wow.
And that brings up the collapse of the Maya, because they were so successful that they were too successful.
Hmm.
They basically outgrew the carrying capacity, the agricultural carrying capacity of their where they lived in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
They cut down the trees. They cut down the trees to burn limestone to make the cement and to cement together the limestone bricks. They deforested, essentially, the Patan, what's called El Patan, the northern part of Guatemala, where all the Mayan, the peak of the Mayan civilization was. And so over time, every city was a different king, a different kingdom. It was kind of like if you think about Greece,
mm-hmm.
Sparta, and Athens, city-states. That's all the Maya were. There were 50-plus city-states. And soon they started to war against each other for the limited resources, less and less resources, so the wars came. But in the end, in 800 and 900 A.D., they had deforested so much of the land that they caused a mini climate change, a micro climate change for that area. Now, scientists know they can look at the mud and the sediments and so on. They can tell that there was this incredible 100-year-long period of major drought. Some lasted 10 years at a time.
Hmm.
And so these cities, these great cities, these great Maya cities, emptied out. Many of them moved north to the Yucatan
mm-hmm.
to be near the coast and so on. But basically that heartland of the Maya, these wonderful cities just emptied out. Because they couldn't, they were dying of starvation, they were dying from the wars, and the population was, they were being depopulated.
Hmm.
And so that's now, I'm just, you know, I'm only saying what the latest research scholars and so on say, and that's what they now believe was the demise of the Mayan civilization. So they were very successful. too successful. Maybe they have something to tell us today. You know, I mean, maybe there's a lesson there. You know, I think
yeah.
there's a lesson.
Hmm. The book is Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. And my guest has been William Carlson. If you were to leave any last-minute thoughts to those who are considering the book, why... what would you say to them? Why would they want to pick up this book? I love the Maya. It's easy for me, and it was an easy read for me. But it's a part of history, isn't it? Is that what you would say? It's a part of history. It's an important part of history.
I think it is. I'm fascinated by history. Actually, the older I grow, the more I you know, the older I become, the more I'm interested in the past and the history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a terrific history, and it's a history that and a biography. Of course, it's a biography of the two men, of course, but it's important because it tells you how two men can change history with their discovery, or change our view of history, and with determination, and guts, and courage, they were able to do this. So, if people like history, and if they like significant history, that's, you know, history about change, if they're at all fascinated with ancient runes and ancient civilizations, and then to top it all off, I mean, I think it's a hell of an adventure story, and as one book reviewer called, said, it makes Indiana Jones seem like a stay-at-home slacker. it's a great adventure story as well, and that's how I wanted to tell it, because this is all the stuff in the book is history and so on, biography, but really it's all pinned on this incredible journey that the two men took.
Very well written too. It's a good read. You're an excellent writer, and I really enjoyed it. Hey, Bill, how can people learn more about your work? What's your website?
Well, the website is William Carlson. That's spelled C-A-R-L-S-E-N, not S-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
WilliamCarlson.com, and you'll see some of you can see some of Catherwood's illustrations there. Some of the reviews of the books of the book, I think the map's there. I'm not sure if the map's there, but I got a little video talking about the book as well. But certainly the Catherwood illustrations, some of them are there, so you can get a good idea of what's in the book that way.
I enjoyed the book.
WilliamCarlson.com.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, hey Bill, thank you very much. Continued success with the book, and those of you who are listening, you should check it out. It's great. It's a great read, and it's quite fascinating to discover how the Maya civilization became known to the world. So, Bill, thanks again.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Cliff. I really appreciate talking with you, and have a great trip to the Yucatan.
You know it. Thanks. So that was William Carlson, Jungle of Stone. I hope you enjoyed that. Next week, we get back into unknown territory, unknown discoveries, unknown history with the discovery of Samoan pyramids. My guest will be Maya Mitchell, who has written a new book on her discoveries. This is something that's not even picked up by major news media at this point. I just found out from her that the book is quickly being picked up by readers as a top new book on the discovery of the Samoan Islands. In this one area, apparently she spent a good deal of time. So next week, look for the undiscovered, unknown Samoan pyramids. I also want to mention that I will be coming out with a series of special edition programs, and we will launch one of these every couple of weeks. So they're midweek programs, so they're not part of the regular scheduled programming that we have each Saturday. These are midweek special editions of Earth Ancients, where I am beginning to speak with best-selling and experts on the levels of consciousness how ancient cultures worked with consciousness. And this is something that I've been playing with and considering for a number of years. It came up in a series of discoveries I made on not only the Maya, but other cultures that we would consider prehistoric. It seems like at a time, these cultures like the Maya, early Chinese, Hindu, actually had a level of cognition that we're beginning to understand. And this level of cognition actually drove them to develop a whole different kind of science. And this is what's been uncovered and continues to be uncovered in Central America with very early cultures. The early Maya, previous to 5,000 years, the ones, the generations who developed these various foodstuffs, who developed sciences like astronomy, medicine, engineering science to build massive pyramids, and also they connected with the earth elements of wind, fire, earth, and water in ways that we're just now understanding. So these special editions are going to cover levels of cognition, levels of mind. We're going to get into ancient telepathy. We're going to get into meditative states. And it's a special edition because it's only for those of you who are interested in those areas. Otherwise, you can just go ahead and hang in there with the regular series, which are going to be continually growing. Now, I have a special panel coming up in October. It's a diffusion panel with Dr. Susan Martinez, Richard Casero, Hugh Newman, Graham Hancock, and maybe one other person speaking on diffusion. In other words, cultural exchange in the ancient past. And I talk about this quite a bit on the program. So stay tuned for that. As always, check on the Facebook page for weekly posts, weekly information. There's galleries there. It's Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. Sometimes we have stuff on the international page. And also check on the website, earthancients.com. Finally, if you can find it time, if you want to travel and actually see Mayan ruins up close and personal, join me October 28th through November 4th for 7 wonderful but intense days of climbing, exploring Mayan ruins that are spectacular. You can go to earthancients.com/tours and read all about it. The entire itinerary is there to check out. Okay, that's it for today. I hope you have a great week. Those of you in Florida, many blessings, and let's hope you get through this hurricane. Have a great day.